Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In August, 23-year-old Irina Zarutska was stabbed to death on Charlotte's light rail. It shocked the nation. It made headlines around the world. Her murder was unprovoked. She didn't know her assailant, nor did she interact with him during their time on the train. The randomness of her death struck a nerve, and as we discovered more about her alleged assailant, so did his criminal history. We found that he had numerous encounters with the courts. He had been arrested 14 times and served 6 years in prison, but was still on the streets. And we discovered that he reportedly suffers from schizophrenia and had a history of psychiatric hospitalizations. In fact, it was reported he had been recently committed by his mother because of her concerns about her son's mental health, but was later released. The recently passed Irina's Law, a bipartisan bill in North Carolina's General Assembly, and which is now law, mandates several things, including requiring magistrates and judges to order evaluations for potential involuntary commitment for defendants believed to pose a danger to themselves or the community. Involuntary commitment for potential mental health issues has been on the rise, but some question its effectiveness. It turns out that just a fraction of these people actually end up making it to a psychiatric inpatient bed, and in a report issued this summer by Disability Rights NC, some view this practice as overused, misused, and harmful. So let's talk about it. We're joined by Mark Botts, Associate Professor of Public Law and Government at the UNC School of Government. He specializes in mental health law and is a recognized expert on North Carolina's involuntary commitment process. Corey Dunn is Director of the Public Policy with Disability Rights North Carolina. And Bob Ward is a retired Assistant Mecklenburg County Public Defender who has represented people facing involuntary commitment. Thank you all for being here. Good morning and welcome. So, Bob, I'm going to start with you because you're one of the lawyers on this panel, and as I said, have represented people in this situation. Involuntary commitment is for people who are struggling with mental health issues or substance abuse who might pose a threat to themselves or to others, and that sounds perfectly reasonable in theory, is it?
Good morning, Mike. It does sound perfectly reasonable in theory. But, you know, in practice, it's very complicated. And people who suffer from mental illnesses, many people do get help. So this isn't something that's for everyone. But when it does happen, when someone is out of control, they need some sort of an intervention. And the medical system, the family system, the police will get involved and they'll take them to the hospital. And the involuntary commitment process itself is a way of giving authority over the person to the medical system. So if you think about a guardianship or something like that, it's a temporary legal authority that allows them not only to sort of hold you against your will, otherwise it's kidnapping, but they also authorize forced medications. And so as you might imagine, as necessary as this might be, it can be very traumatic.
So, Corey, the use of involuntary commitment has been on the rise, as I said, at least that's what I read yesterday, for over a decade in this state. It nearly doubled from 2011 to 2021. Why?
Really, the root of the problem, Mike, is that our community-based mental health system is under-resourced and is too difficult to access. So more people are going into crisis and not getting help until that point. And as one physician described to us, the IVC is the easy button. It is, it provides a process that is appealing to families, healthcare providers, because it gives authority to those folks. That doesn't mean it's effective treatment or, in the long run, a particularly productive intervention.
And what I'm hearing you say, and perhaps I read this yesterday in all the voluminous amount of material that I read to get ready for this, is that this should be a last resort. That people are we're putting people into these involuntary commitment situations because they haven't been able to get the support or haven't gotten the mental health support that they need. And as we will find out as this conversation continues, when they are going to involuntary commitment, they often don't get the help that they need, or they don't get it for a very long time after they've surrendered their rights. Mark, what has been the because of the Irina Zarudzka murder, and because of the alleged defendant in that case, well, the defendant in that case, the alleged murderer in that case, having been in and out of jail over time, and people getting very upset with, including the Fraternal Order of Police, with people who are arrested and then put immediately back on the streets, and people who have mental issues who perhaps should be receiving treatment. We've had a lot of people say, well, the system doesn't work. What has been the criteria for involuntarily committing someone for psychiatric or mental health care? How much of the decision process is prescribed by law, and how much of it is subjectively applied by magistrates and judges?
Mark. Well, it's a process, it's a judicial process that's prescribed by law, and magistrates and judges do their best to implement that law. One could ask, you know, or if there are problems, is it a problem in the design of the law, or is it a problem in the implementation? So I do a lot of education with judicial officials, law enforcement officers, and clinicians on involuntary commitment law and procedure. We have to understand involuntary commitment is court-ordered treatment without the consent of the individual subject to that court order. For a court to order someone to be treated in a locked inpatient facility, a court hearing has to be held where the individual is represented by counsel, and the court must find that the individual, due to a mental illness, is dangerous to himself or others. That's the basic criteria, dangerousness, which was established long ago with a Supreme Court case called O'Connor v. Donaldson. Someone has to be dangerous to self or others for the state to confine them. And because the state is acting to substitute its judgment for the mentally ill person, based on the premise that that person is not able to voluntarily seek and comply with treatment on their own, the state steps in, substitutes its judgment. And for the safety of that person and the public, the involuntary commitment process starts. It's a cumbersome, unwieldy process. It is hard to say, it's hard to evaluate the process or the design and the law because there are insufficient resources to actually implement the law fully. People enter into the involuntary commitment process, we like to say IVC process, and often, even if they do meet the criteria for commitment, they don't get to the final destination, i.e. a state psych hospital or other psychiatric hospital, because they are full and there's insufficient capacity to meet the flow of people coming into the pipeline.
And we're going to talk about that. But I'm curious, in your opinion, Mark, this new law that they just passed at the General Assembly in response to the murder in Charlotte, Irina's law, does it do anything to fix any of the problems that you are aware of and that you have just alluded to?
Well, it looks at the pretrial release or pretrial condition process at the time that an officer brings an arrestee to a magistrate and when a magistrate's determining whether or not to charge the individual. So that's just one small piece of a much larger criminal process. What it does is for those who are believed to be dangerous to themselves or others, at that point in the process, the law refers them over into the involuntary commitment process, which is a separate parallel process that can occur. So it attempts to identify people who need help. However, it does that only at one point of many points in a larger process, and it will likely increase the number of people going into the IVC process, involuntary commitment process, without addressing the fact that that process, that system right now is already over capacity and cannot handle all the people coming into it. Now, I know that it's just the first legislative step, and there's a legislative committee set up to look at other things. And so the General Assembly may be looking at other pieces of the puzzle here, but this is just one piece at one stage of a criminal process. There are many other things that could be looked at.
So, Corey Dunn, you are awesome. Go ahead.
So I'm gonna go ahead and add that we are talking about IVC and a criminal charge together because of this specific incident. But the vast majority of involuntary commitments have nothing to do with the criminal system. The vast majority of people subject to IVC are experiencing a crisis. They are in distress, and they are deemed by someone to be a risk to themselves or others. That doesn't mean that they have committed or are charged with any kind of crime. So these are legally separate processes that sometimes happen in parallel or simultaneously.
And you can speak to legal processes because you too are a lawyer, but you're also the director of Disability Rights NC. And this summer, your organization issued a report asserting that involuntary commitment in North Carolina is, quote, overused, misused, and harmful. But at the same time, that report states more children and adults than ever need access to mental health services. So in addition to your criticisms, which we will discuss as we go through this program, is your organization essentially saying that involuntary commitment is a less effective tool or wouldn't be necessary if we had sufficient mental health services on the front end before people reached a crisis?
That's it, Mike. We are looking at the number of people whose first access to a mental health care provider is in a hospital emergency department. That is an absurd way to deliver mental health services. And it's inefficient and it's ineffective. So it costs us more money. And it also doesn't make people well as readily as voluntary treatment or other interventions. And as our report details, there are horrific stories of the collateral consequences of involuntary commitment, where we know that involuntary commitment isn't a kindness or a gesture of support. It is essentially a restriction of people's liberty, right? This is, as Mark said, it is, or maybe Bob said, it is restricting someone's movement and restricting their ability to make decisions about their own health care. And that is called for in very rare circumstances. But we use it very often for reasons that have nothing to do with the actual clinical indications. For example, we discuss in our report that many people are IVC'd in order to access transportation, because then law enforcement officers are required to transport them to the next site where they can receive services.
IVC, by the way, is shorthand for involuntary commitment. We're going to come back and talk more about this and what this new ARENAs law does and does not do, and the executive order recently released by the Trump administration dealing with involuntary commitment of homeless people and what that may mean going forward as well. We're here with Corey Dunn, the last voice you heard, Director of Public Policy for Disability Rights NC, Bob Ward, a retired public defender, and Mark Botts, Associate Professor of Law at UNC.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at HabitatCharlotteRegion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about involuntary commitment in North Carolina, how, when, where, and why it is used, and how effective it is or is not, with Mark Botts, Associate Professor of Public Law and Government at the UNC School of Government, Corey Dunn is Director of Public Policy with Disability Rights NC, and Bob Ward is a former Assistant Public Defender in Mecklenburg County who has worked with these clients who need or who have been involuntary. Voluntarily committed. IRENA's law, which was a recent law passed by the legislature in response to the murder on the Blue Line, adds, as I understand it, no funding for the state's mental health system. Kate Weaver, who is the executive director of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, the largest grassroots organization in the country supporting people with mental illness and their families, says, quote, when people are with serious mental illness don't receive consistent care, there are risks, which we have already talked about, but Irina Zarutska's alleged murderer is said to suffer from mental illness. So why was this incident, which so galvanized the world, actually, but when you think about the news reports flowing around the world, it was a catalyst for so much concern and action, but not one for increasing access to mental health care. Mark, can you explain that?
Well, you're asking me to step into the minds of policymakers, and I'm not sure I can do that. I can tell you that, yes, IRENA's law uses the criminal process as a tool to identify some people who commit a crime, who may be mentally ill and dangerous to self or others, and meet the involuntary commitment process. And in addition to other pretrial conditions of release, for those people who are identified to be dangerous due to a mental illness, it would refer them to an involuntary commitment examiner for an evaluation to see if they can be provided treatment through that involuntary commitment process. But you ask a good question. What about that person with a mental illness? What's happening with them before they commit a crime or before they're arrested for a criminal offense? Are they receiving treatment in the community? Is there anyone out there that provides the kind of care, assistance, and support that someone with a very serious mental illness might need? Because some mental illnesses affect a person's insight and judgment and ability to consent to or seek treatment voluntarily. We do have community-based services for people who have trouble staying on medication and staying in treatment. We have community services like assertive community treatment teams, a team of multidisciplinary professionals, and a behavioral health care agency that will go to where the individual lives, whether that's at their residence or under a bridge, and make sure they're on their medications, provide medication support and other treatment. The question is, was DeCarlos Brown, did he need that kind of service? Was he receiving that kind of service? Did he have the ability to pay for that service if he did need it? Those are lots of policy questions we could look at. I don't know the answers in his case in particular, but they are questions that arise with many people.
So this issue is pressing now, Bob, because of Irina Zarutska's murder and the mental issues allegedly involving her killer, but also because the Donald Trump administration has issued an executive order titled Ending Crime and Disorder on America's Streets, which includes provisions to expand the use of involuntary civil commitment for homeless individuals with mental illness or substance abuse disorders. It encourages shifting the homeless into long-term institutional settings, including psychiatric hospitals, and prioritizes funding for states that criminalize homelessness. In other words, those states get more money if they make being homeless a criminal activity. Would that be legal? Would it be a violation of a person's constitutional rights? Bob.
Well, that's a tough question, Mike. It's not something that has come across my desk since I've been doing it, but I to speculate some, you know, I think you could probably analogize this more to Americans with Disabilities Act, all right, where people have rights and privileges and people understand that they are in need of services. You wouldn't take away wheelchairs from people who need wheelchairs. But in many respects, our society has taken away the wheelchairs from people. They've removed these services. And then imagine saying that now we're going to criminalize those folks. I mean, it's preposterous, but that is what we're doing. And to your earlier question about why this attention and why they react this way, you know, and in other places, in Memphis many years ago, there was a capital killing. It was a horrible case, but NAMI got involved and it shifted the whole discussion. They worked with Police Chief Sam Cochran there and let him know that they needed more mental health training, and crisis intervention teams came out of that, which was a tremendous benefit to us. If you look at mental health courts, they came out of Fort Lauderdale. There was a capital case there, but there were people already working on these mental health issues and the lack of services there. And that community responded differently than what we have seen, not at just at the state level, but also at the national level. And I'm certain people could you know, people who could do class action lawsuits and that type of thing might be able to raise those arguments. But at a basic human level, this is common sense. You just don't treat people who are sick as criminals.
So in cases where involuntary commitment could be deemed necessary by medical professionals, by legal professionals, even by family members, the problem is it doesn't work particularly well, at least not in North Carolina, Bob. Let's talk about how this actually works from your experience as somebody who has represented people who may or may not have been the candidates for involuntary commitment. Who generally asks for someone to be involuntarily committed? Is it a family member? Is it a prosecutor? Is it something that's simply mandated by law? So the judge or the magistrate has to, that's the sentence, that's the decision? How does it work?
Well, good question, right? And like Corey said, it's actually a very small percentage of folks who come in through the criminal system. It's in average, what you'll have is a family situation, or it might be a neighbor or a police officer, or someone is present when someone seems out of sorts. They may be able to convince them to go to the hospital, and it might be under a pretense. Hey, you look like you might be having a stroke or something, but you could get someone to the hospital. The vast majority of mental health commitments come from the hospitals themselves, because when they see that this person is out of sorts, they begin it. And it's a multi-stage process, but the very initial one is there with the hospital.
So whether you are involuntarily committed because a judge says you have to be, or the hospital recognizes a situation in a patient, or a family member pleads for this to happen, and it does happen, what happens next, Bob? What happens to that individual once they have been involuntarily committed?
Excellent question. Now, one thing I want to clarify too, dangerousness to self or others can mean a lot of things to different people, not just because of the severity, but also the time frame. So this has to happen within a very short period of time that someone has exhibited some behavior. If it was a month ago and that they threatened suicide, they can't get committed now, but it's got to be today, yesterday, a series of things. They go to the hospital, they get a hold order for 24 hours. They can only hold them for 24 hours based on that petition. They have to have another, and a doctor has to say, yes, you need to stay. Within another 24 hours period or so, it's complicated. But basically, another doctor has to say, if you're going to be held longer, another doctor has to come in. So you have to have two doctors to hold you for the hearing. You've not seen a judge, you've not seen a lawyer, you're just at the hospital. Within 10 days of that initial petition, okay, when that initial magistrate order saying that you're to be held, you have to have a commitment proceeding. That's where I get involved as the assistant public defender, or it may be a farm out attorney if you're in some other setting, could be private attorney. But what happens then is there's a standard of proof at the hearing that is different from the very first time you came in. You're not litigating what happened when you came in. You're actually saying, presently, today, are you by clear, convincing and cogent evidence, are you a danger to yourself and others and having a mental illness? And then if you have a hearing on that, because you can continue the case if they're cooperating and getting better, you don't have to have the hearing. But what happens is if they are committed, it's for a period of time, maybe 30 days, might be an outpatient commitment for 90 days, but that's kind of what happens.
And at minimum, it sounds like a minimum of 11 to 12 days once you've been deemed somebody eligible for involuntary commitment, because there's that 24-hour period where doctors have to see you and pass judgment, and then there's 10 days before the hearing. So that's 11 to 12 days. Disability Rights NC says the practice is overused, misused, and harmful. Corey, let's take those separately. Why do you view this as an overused, misused process?
It is overused because people have difficulty navigating our mental health care system. And so this is one way that family members in many cases or healthcare providers can ensure that someone is connected with mental health services. I really do think that most petitions for involuntary commitment are filed out of a concern for the well-being of the person who's subject to that commitment. And that custody order, that very first order that says you may not leave, that is not the final judicial order that is legally the involuntary commitment, but it certainly feels like a commitment. It is carceral in nature. You can't move your body out of that emergency department, law enforcement vehicle, wherever you are, once that custody order is executed. So it's overused because people see it and know that it is a process they can access, whereas our community-based mental health system, you gotta call your local MCO or your insurance company. You've got to find a local healthcare provider. You've, in many cases, wait for 6, 10. A couple years ago, the waits were up in the months and years for a spot on an outpatient therapy roster. It is tough to access those services.
And in what way is it harmful, aside from the fact that you lose your liberty for X amount of weeks?
So losing your liberty, I think we have to be clear, is in and of itself a harm. So I want to be clear about that. But also, it doesn't provide effective treatment. In many cases, it actually creates a real distrust between people with a mental health disability and their loved ones, the people who might have petitioned for them to be committed, or their healthcare providers. And that distrust makes it harder for people to continue to engage in treatment long-term. And we know that trust is essential to effective treatment. In fact, the rates of self-harm go up dramatically shortly after release from an involuntary commitment process. We see spikes in suicide and suicidal attempts, purposeful acts in the direction of suicide after release from involuntary commitment.
So and disability, Mike, right. Go ahead.
It's a little complicated. I don't know. It gets quite complicated, but to try to address some of what Corey said, I don't necessarily disagree with the idea that it's quote unquote overused, but why is that, or what does that mean? Some people feel that it's the measure of it being overused is because there's so many people coming into the process, and because the state doesn't have the capacity to actually meet the treatment needs, even in the commitment process, even in an inpatient commitment setting, all the people coming into it. The state is the state institutional psychiatric care system is bursting at the seams. It can't take on all the people flowing into it. And so you could say, okay, so that's too many people. It's overused. On the other hand, you could say, well, it's not overused because the people who are coming into it actually meet the criteria according to state law. And that's what the law is set up to do. Well, you could then say, well, if we had sufficient community resources to meet the needs of people with serious mental illness, they wouldn't deteriorate to the point of needing acute emergency care. And the way to stem the flow into the system is to provide better community-based resources to keep people more well or prevent them from getting sick enough to the point that they meet the commitment criteria.
And
Bob, I want
you
to point out that a third of the beds in the state psychiatric hospitals are filled with people who are actually ready for discharge. They no longer meet medical necessity for hospital level of care. A third of the people in our state psychiatric hospitals cannot be discharged because there are not adequate community-based supports to discharge them to.
Well, that was my next point. Bob says that because as someone who has defended people with mental challenges, you have said that civil commitments of any kind, adult, minor, inpatient, outpatient, are useless in the absence of the right treatment and supportive services once a person comes home. Is that a standard, is that an opinion that is widely held in the legal and mental health community? Bob.
Oh, yes. I think what's really hard too is that historically, at least for me, I started in public defender's office in 1986. One of my first jobs there was IVCs, and it was a different world. I mean, you didn't have the medications you have now. That's the sad thing, is that we actually have a lot of good treatment out there. They're just not investing in it. And you had the continuing care division with social workers who came and helped.
Sorry, when you say they are just not investing in it, who are you referring to?
In this situation, in our state, it is the state legislature. Okay, I will tell you that the state legislature has come down and said, blamed the situation on the Charlotte mayor and our police department and so forth. I will say categorically, the owner of this problem is the state legislature. They've designed this and either funded it or not funded it. And historically, like I say, there was a time when we had more social workers, more case managers, we had more community support. I remember when we were told in 2009 that community support was going away and that the family members now were the community support. Now you imagine this. You have a system that all of a sudden makes family members community support without notice or training or equipping, and you are setting up for this problem that we have today, and that has just continued. And I'm hopeful. I really am hopeful with this committee that's been established that somehow somebody will allow this side of the story to come out, and that people will invest in this. It's a lot cheaper. It's a lot safer, and it's morally correct to do. You take care of sick people. You don't criminalize them.
And in the course of doing other programs on this topic and on law enforcement, it is clear that the Congress underfunds police departments right now under the Trump administration. They're cutting funding to police departments at a time when everybody wants more law and more order. And the court system in North Carolina is heavily overburdened and can't handle the caseload. And that is a problem of funding from the state government. And that it, all of us, it seems like the perfect storm coming home to roost. When we come back, I want to get more deeply into this report from the Disability Rights Organization, NC organization that Corey Dunn is in charge of. And one particular thing that struck me as perhaps a violation of a person's rights. We'll get to that in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the Gambrill Center at Queens, presenting Earthwise, a public series exploring our connection to nature through science, film, art, literature, and lived stories. Part of their Connected Campus program. More at gambrillcenter.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about involuntary commitment in North Carolina with Mark Botts, Associate Professor of Public Law and Government at the UNC School of Government. Corey Dunn is Director of Public Policy with Disability Rights NC. And Bob Ward is a former Assistant Public Defender, now retired from Mecklenburg County. This report from Disability Rights NC says that once a, quote, magistrate signs a custody order, a civil, not criminal order, authorizing law enforcement agencies to detain and transport a person to a hospital, that child or adult cannot leave. Their liberty is quite literally in legal limbo because the law does not provide for an attorney or hearing in the emergency department. That seems, Mark, like an enormous oversight and a violation of a person's rights, because many times, I suppose, these people do need to have that period of involuntary commitment, do need the medical help, don't have the ability, the mental capacity to make that decision for themselves. But there could be times when that is not the case, it seems to me. Has there ever been any move to correct that in the law, to give a person a right to an attorney immediately?
Well, when the law was written decades ago, the design was that while someone would go as a result of a magistrate custody order to a hospital emergency room for a commitment exam, if that examiner found they met the inpatient commitment criteria, they would be transported forthwith to an inpatient facility where they would receive a second exam, have an attorney appointed to represent them, and have a hearing calendared. So originally, it didn't take that long to get to a hearing and to be represented by counsel and to have the full range of due process protections. But what's happened, the reason is what's happened is because there's no room at the end, because there's often no space in the 24-hour facilities. People back up in the emergency room, awaiting transport, awaiting a place to go, and we'll sit there for days or weeks. That was not intended when the law was originally written. That's a problem that has not really been addressed. So yes, while the law says you're entitled to a hearing within 10 days of being taken into custody, but because people were not getting to facilities in enough time for that law to be effective and to get the hearing within 10 days, the General Assembly said, well, we can hold people for successive 7-day periods if the hospital keeps going back to the magistrate and renewing the custody order.
I want to really emphasize what Mark just said there, that you said a small thing and it is enormous. We allow for successive petitions, which means we've had clients who spend weeks and months living in a hospital emergency department without access to counsel or judicial review.
And so that's, you could say that, you know, one could look at, okay, why is that happening? Well, it's insufficient resources dedicated to the inpatient facilities that would need to take the flow of people with the numbers of people coming into the system. Or you could look at making changes to the law and providing greater due process protection while they're waiting in the emergency room.
Is this the case for the case that you just cited, where people can wait for months because the hospital can petition for an extension? Is that only in specifically in situations where the court has ordered this, or is this a situation sometimes where the family has requested this? Is it always?
It doesn't matter who initiates the petition. Okay. There's always a magistrate who signs off on that petition to create the custody order.
So as someone who has defended these individuals in courts, Bob, don't their defense attorneys, public or otherwise, monitor the progress of the case as it goes through these hospital systems and ensure that these people are not being held against their will, essentially, for months and months and months because of underfunding of a system that doesn't seem to be able to accommodate them? Doesn't the defense attorney get involved in this?
Yes, and I try very hard. And I'll give you an example of why. I mean, it's not just the medical system that's underfunded. It's also the legal system. We haven't even gotten into that zone about what resources are not available to me as somebody who handles this. And just think about this. From 2012 until 2023, when I retired, I handled the IBCs in McMurray County. I was the primary, the only guy. So technically, I would have been your attorney for an IBC process. So my potential client base is a million people. This is one attorney coming through. We have thousands of people coming through. I probably went, a year, maybe 2,000, 2,500 a year, but that was only about 20-25% of the actual commitments. I argued and tried to get resources where we could get attorney appointments at the time of the initial commitment, so you could get that. Our system does not allow for that. And I'd advocated for it. You couldn't do it. So I had clients who had been stuck for weeks at those IVC or, you know, in the emergency rooms. I had one client who was there for 4 months, and it was the doctor who got so frustrated that he added it on the docket or somehow got it on there. I got appointed. We were able to get them out. And it turned out he was partly stuck there. There's a complex situation, but partly stuck there because it turned out he couldn't be moved to the psychiatric hospital because he needed a CPAP, and a CPAP was a risk for them. So a CPAP was keeping a guy in a hospital. So it's these types of things that we tend to talk about it being a system. It really isn't a system. It's just this collection of different processes, and nobody's managing it.
So let me ask you this. This is probably very puzzling. It's puzzling to me, and I'm sure it's puzzling to our listeners, because you were talking here this morning about people being involuntarily committed for good reason or not, and then having to spend months in these involuntary situations because the system is not a system and it doesn't really work the way it was intended to work, and they're understaffed and overwhelmed, essentially. And yet, in the case of DeCarlos, I can't think of his last name now.
DeCarlos Brown, I believe.
DeCarlos Brown, Zarina Zarutska's alleged attacker. In his case, his mother had him committed for 14 days because he was too much for her to handle, and the hospital had to let him out, which is why he was on the street in the first place. Explain that to me.
Well, see, that goes back to the question of, even if we use the involuntary commitment process, even though it's a necessary and important tool in some cases when someone's illness gets to an acute phase and they're dangerous to themselves or others, the question is, what happens after that? When you stabilize them in an inpatient setting and they get better, they get well, when it comes to discharging them, what are you discharging them to? So this is a question to ask with respect to the president's executive order that seeks to expand the use of involuntary commitment. Is, let's say we have the capacity to do that. Let's say all the states will appropriate more money to increase inpatient capacity. You still have the question, you can't, what happens when you discharge people, because you can't hold them indefinitely. When they become not dangerous because you're providing them treatment in an inpatient setting, the law requires them to be discharged. Are what kind of care, support, treatment are they going to be discharged to? And a lot of times, whether they get any treatment or not will be a function of whether or not they can pay for that treatment. If there's not a payor for the community-based outpatient treatment, then they're going to have a lot of trouble accessing that treatment. So the involuntary commitment process is used in a way as an access point for people who are seriously mentally ill. But once they're discharged, the question is, are they going to have access to the preventive care, to the community's resources?
So Bob, Corey, maybe both of you can answer this question, because this is the case that really got people upset, and rightfully so. I've forgotten the question. I go back.
Can I suggest
it's mind-boggling. Yes, so, please go ahead.
I think that when there is a crisis like this, we look for the tools that are available to us. And certainly people have looked at IVC as a potential tool that is available to address a very complex problem. I would suggest that it is, we're asking a lot of a process that is intended to be very narrowly used, and that it is not the best or most effective or most cost-effective tool at our disposal.
I guess the question I was going to ask is, there's, in the aftermath of this, there has been a lot of finger-pointing going on and accusations of certain politicians and certain cities being soft on crime, and this wouldn't have happened if we had better measures. Is any of that true, Bob? Or is this a problem with what we've been talking about? Insufficient resources on the front end, a system that's not really a system, that doesn't work very well, and nothing on the back end when they get out?
Well, it's not true. I mean, I think this is what's somewhat frustrating to me, and I'm grateful for this show and some other stories that have been out. People have sort of, shoot first and aim later. They're basically taking some actions, and I can see people are very upset. Somebody has to do something. And I like what Corey said, that people are looking for the immediate and they're trying to take care of this, and they're acting out of fear and out of anger and so forth. But that doesn't necessarily make good policy. It doesn't necessarily make good systems. And that's why I'm looking forward to this legislative committee, regardless of where people stand politically. I'm just hopeful that people will start having a conversation, invite people in. I spent 20 years working with drug treatment courts. When we first started, there were similar type of antagonisms between groups. You know, some believed in treatment, some didn't. And people were very, you know, very, you know, oppositional to each other. But when they came to the table and looked at the real problem, it was amazing to me how a lot of those, not only did you overcome those things, but the different perspectives added to the quality. And so I'm hoping that that can come out of this. But I also think when you ask that question about, and I can't speak specifically about, you know, Mr. Brown's case, but just generally speaking, when the Continuing Care Division was here, they strategically used commitments. I had people that I would see in the commitment zone. I'd see them at the jail. I'd see them in the courtroom. And there were these regulars. They, you know, and they disappeared in a couple of years. And what happened was that the social workers had these caseloads, and they would monitor, they would help support, they provide housing or at least, you know, access to that type of thing. And for some reason, they made it work. And if they saw somebody starting to deteriorate, you know, they would go ahead and initiate an outpatient commitment. And then that outpatient commitment, they'd take them over just to check them out over at the emergency room so that if it looked like they were really needing medication or another shot, they could take care of it. But they were very proactive and they put that in place. And when the state changed and went to the reform system that, you know, they did, which essentially privatized it and made it very hard for people with high integrated needs to get help, when they did that, they took away this case management. So, you know, if I were to kind of insert, well, what should we be doing? And I would recommend the county doing this or somebody, even if the state's not, it's just hiring some more social workers to look at your people that are coming in more frequently, see if you can engage them to get them help. And then also they can help you find out where the gaps are in the system and provide some help.
This legislative committee that's been alluded to several times, let's talk about that briefly, because around the time of the passage of ARENA's law, the Republican House Speaker, Destin Hall, announced the formation of the Select Committee on Involuntary Commitment and Public Safety to come up with solutions to keep dangerous people off the streets and to, quote, study and make recommendations regarding the intersection of mental health services, involuntary commitment, and public safety. Do we know, Mark, if any of the problems and deficiencies that we have been talking about will be among the things that they will be studying and trying to find solutions for? Do we have any idea?
I personally don't know the answer to that question, but I think what your suggestion would be a logical pursuit of the committee, because what ARENA's law does, it's really a first step at looking at all of this. It uses the criminal law to identify those offenders who may have a mental illness that's so serious that they need to be examined. They need to be evaluated to see if they need treatment. So what does ARENA's law do? How does ARENA's law do that? It uses the involuntary commitment statutes, the involuntary commitment process, as the tool for identifying some offenders who have a serious mental illness and need treatment. Okay, but then the question is, so that's a very logical, rational thing to do. But as we've discussed, there's limitations to the IVC law. And does that tool need to be changed or refined to handle these kind of criminal justice referrals? And or are there other tools that we should look at? So I think the appropriate way to look at ARENA's law is it's a logical first step by a General Assembly that's concerned about what happened and what could happen, but it's only one step and many steps that probably need to be taken, at least in terms of considering what could be done to get
so
people
I have about,
the people
I have
they
a,
need.
I have about 90 seconds left, and we've covered a lot of the negatives of involuntary commitment. Corey, Bob, are there any positives, any good things that come out of it, in your opinion? Corey, I'll start with you.
What we see from our clients is an increase in self-harm after release and a distrust of the system. In most cases, we see that it actually makes it harder for people to engage in treatment long-term, which we know is essential to success.
And Bob, your take on this?
I will say, doing treatment courts, people who graduated would thank the officer who had arrested them. I mean, they said that helped me get, I've never had a client say, I'm grateful for having been involuntarily committed. They're grateful for treatment. And I will tell you that when people get medications, it can be, it's miraculous when they get the support that they have, it's miraculous.
And we don't have time to talk about it, but you sent us an article, Bob, from the New York Times from several years ago about something called psychiatric advance directives. And these are not unlike the advance directives that you would sign for your physical health should you find yourself on a hospital and unable to make a decision about your treatment. It's already prescribed because you've put it on in writing. How often are these used? Very quickly, 10 seconds.
It's another show. Not much, but they are great.
And one individual said that document changed his life, just so we all put that on the table. That's Bob Ward, assistant public defender, retired from Mecklenburg County, Corey Dunn, director of public policy with disability rights, NC, and Mark Botts, associate professor of public law and government at the UNC School of Government. Thank you all for the hour.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.